Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, June 3rd, 1996. In the fireside room this morning, our speaker is Tom Perry. His subject, the Chelans, salmon, coyote, and teepees. Let's listen in.
Give him a second to roll his tape there. This session I've titled The Chelans, but it's really about a whole network of native groups from this area that occupy the west bank of the Columbia. I guess I should start with some geography here. Both in linguistic and I guess ethnic terms, we think of the middle Columbia roughly from about the Okanagan River down to south of Wenatchee as a region. And the people who lived on the south end of Lake Chelan are referred to as the Chelan. They're not exactly a tribe. Generally, we distinguish between a tribe and a band. A band is sort of an offshoot from a part of a tribe. And it's difficult to think of tribes as hierarchical organizations because they are more lateral organizations in that the chiefs of bands will arrange marriages so they have good alliances, they'll be cousins and so forth, and they're sort of loose federations. And all of these people in the middle of Columbia were related this way. They're ethnically and linguistically related. They all spoke the same basic language. I'm going to refer to the people of this region as First Nations people, which is a designation that the First Nations people that I work with prefer. Although they have no objection to Indian or Native people, they think of it as more accurate, particularly for political and public relations purposes. They point out that they are not native to this region, that they are immigrants as well, just a long time ago. And so they like to think of them as the First Nations. And they are treated by the governments of both Canada and the United States as nations. They have treaties with these governments. They are not subsumed under most federal law. So they have a distinct character within the countries that they live in. So that's what I'm going to be talking about. And as I said, this large Middle Columbia region was for many years, the people around here have been lumped under this designation, Middle Columbia. If you look them up in the lists of languages of this region, you find Middle Columbia Salish. You don't find the particular local groups from around here. But what happened last year was a fellow from Manson, who's a historian, went through all the old shoeboxes people had under their beds and wrote a book called Wapato Heritage, which tells the story of the local First Nations people. He calls it the history of the Chelan and Entiat Indians, and that's mostly who it's about. And as far as affecting the way that Lake Chelan developed, certainly those two groups had the most influence. However, there are a lot of different groups that played important roles. And in particular, the somewhat larger group, which are simply called the Columbias, who lived east of the Columbia, turned out to have been very important in dealing with Washington and what happened to the lands that these people occupied. The other thing that I wanted to talk about was the importance of the land around here for all of these native groups, because it's a central issue, and it's one that white settlers did not understand, and we still don't understand, because we know, for example, that they did not have a concept of land ownership. And the idea of Well, that when the governments came in and said, why don't you take this land, they, you know, the sort of thing we usually say is, well, they didn't really understand this concept. But this this comes mostly from an attitude that is actually the reverse of this, in that they don't own the land, but the land owns them. That they see themselves, as Gary Snyder puts it, as the original and eternal inhabitants of this land. And so it is totally involved in, among other things, their religion. All of their myths are related to very specific land issues. And they will have myths about local landmarks and how they came to be. And that's part of their understanding of the world, and may include things like the creation stories and so forth. Okay, so I'm going to just kind of give you an overview of the culture that existed around here before the settlers came, and we'll get up to about the time the settlers start arriving. But I title this thing, this session, Salmon, Coyote, and Teepees, because those are cultural elements that I think are indicative of what was found here in the 1900s, or the 1800s. The people were Salish people. How many of you are from the West Coast here? Are you
Washington?
On the west side?
No.
Oh.
From Wisconsin.
You're from Wisconsin, okay.
I've lived on the west side.
Yes. Most of the groups up and down the Washington coast, at least the interior coast, not out on the outside Olympic Peninsula, but are Salish people. And I think most concepts of Salish people are as coastal people. And there is one thing in common between the interior Salish and the coastal Salish, and that's salmon. So that's one of the factors. Their culture is based on salmon, and you won't find Salish people where there is no salmon run. Consequently, they did not live in Railroad Creek Valley. They lived over the mountain here in the Entiat Valley because the Entiat River has a salmon run. So that's one thing. Coyote is indicative of the mythology and the religion that they used. It turns out that people adapted to the land they eventually occupied. And whether they're Salish or not, they tended to incorporate the mythology of the people who lived in that region. So there are Salish and non-Salish people who have the same set of stories about this area. And they have basically the same religion. The same is true on the coast. For example, you go up the coast, and particularly further north, and you look at the art, you know, the sort of northwest coast art that you see. Ethnically, these people are from entirely diverse origins, but they have the same art. And they adapt to the place that they are. So there's not strong ethnic differences that we would find in other places that are external. Their languages are different, but things like their art and their myths and their religion tend to converge when they live in the same area. And Coyote is one of the mythical characters that's true of most of the interior peoples, whether they're Salish or not. Coyote is known as the trickster, has many of the aspects of the devil, for example, many of the things that are natural catastrophes have somehow to do with Coyote. But he also has other attributes. There are myths about Coyote that explain things like how certain things came to be. So he's a very important figure in the mythology. And then teepees is the other thing, because the one thing that sets interior Salish people apart from the coastal peoples is that they seem more like plains Indians, in that they do things like live in teepees during the summer, which you would never find on the coast. In fact, there's a great picture on the cover here of Wapato Point down in Manson in the summer in the 20s.
all these teepees, each with a Model T Ford parked outside of it.
And now maybe that was the predecessor to the condos.
Yeah. Wapato, incidentally, many times people will say that refer to the First Nations people from Lake Chelan as Wapatos. That's not what they were called. That is a family name of an Entiat chief, a fellow named Wapato John. It became their family name, their last name. Wapato John was called that because he was the first First Nations person who was a farmer and rancher. And Wapato in Chinook means potato. Chinook is the trade language that many of the whites and Native people used up and down the Columbia and out to the coast, so that they didn't have to learn, you know, 17 different languages. They could just use Chinook. And so he got that name sometime about the time that the folks around here started taking English names because settlers were coming in. So it would be the late 1900s, 1870s, 1880s. So let's go back to the beginning, though, and take a look at the map. The people who inhabit this area came originally from Siberia at least 15,000 years ago. That's already too late to be, or too long ago for linguistic archaeology or even physical archaeology to tell us a whole lot about where they came from. The fact that the people who became the Salish people were totally based on a salmon culture suggests that they came from similar rivers in Siberia originally, where there are similar salmon, the same species of salmon, actually. And that when they found something to their liking, they settled there. And crossed the land bridge into Alaska, and they kept on migrating down, not the coast, which was just too difficult to migrate along. There were wide rivers to cross all the time. You'd be switching back and forth between boats and traveling by land, and it would be a long process. It was a long process anyway, but it was easier. The sort of corridor migration was down the Intermountain region between the Cascades and the Rockies, which is called the Plateau. And the way the coast got populated was moving down rivers. So they would follow the major rivers down. The Fraser in Canada and the Columbia here were obviously the biggest corridors. We know that the Skagit River, which starts up in Canada in a low pass, moves down here, and even from Lake Chelan through into the upper Skagit on Cascade Pass, which is this red dot. And those were very long-standing ancient corridors for migration for the local people. Even when the Chelans lived here, they had a lot of traffic with the coast through Cascade Pass. Not all of it friendly. They actually, probably in the 18th century still, were having wars with the Snohomish. And they would carry each other's women off, which was the thing to do back then. Some of the chiefs of the Chelans and Entiats had Snohomish grandmothers. These migrations, of course, they kept on going. That was the way that all the Americas were populated. But probably very early on, these rivers were populated. It turns out, of all the sort of landscapes that they found, you know, this coast in particular was one of the most abundant. Of all the early American peoples, these people along in this area were among, well, they're certainly the best nourished in terms of their diet. They had one of the best diets going. Even back over here, in here, things were not quite so good for the people back there. you would get, the winter is more severe, you get spring shortages and so forth. But that never seemed to happen over here. There was always enough salmon, enough enough vegetable diet and so forth. Okay, now the Salish people, as you can see, they extend all the way down this coast. They extend down through the Intermountain Corridor, roughly down into the southern Columbia region. And then you get into different ethnic groups. Below here, for example, the Klamaths down in Oregon belong to the Penutian stock, which is an enormous group that that encompasses most of the languages or the ethnic groups of California. They were the First Nations people of California. Many of them, and particularly Northern California, were Penutian. And that group even goes down into Mexico, into Northern Mexico. So there were sort of great ethnic divisions which wouldn't have been noticeable, because if you were in this area, you could look at the Yakimas down here, and they behaved very much like the Columbias, even though they were ethnically different people. Their customs, their way of life, and everything was pretty much the same. The Salish people in the interior were divided into two groups, the northern and then the middle Columbia. The northern ones, mostly in Canada, up in the Fraser River area, the Thompson River area, there's one group there, something called the Thompsons. And they have a southern group that comes down the Okanagan River, and they're called the Okanagans. One of the things about these river people is that you see all these different tribal names. They're really not tribal names, they're river names. They are the people who live on the river. And so they're always named after the river. So the Okanagans, you know, live in the Okanagan Valley, which stretches up into Canada. They are northern Salish, and so they're ethnically different from this bunch here. And their language is not as comprehensible to these people as they were themselves. Within the grouping of the Middle Columbias, as I said, there were the Columbias over here, who were very much more oriented to this sort of plains way of life, because that area over there is more deserty and plain life. And it was they, for example, who introduced the idea of going out to hunt buffalo. Because all of these peoples eventually got into the buffalo hunting business when they got horses, which was about 1730. Horses came into America from the Spanish, and they moved up the western plateau. And there was a big business in horse trading in the Old West. And this was well before any contact with white settlers. The Middle Columbia peoples got horses by trading down from further south. So the four groups that we have on this side on the West Bank are the Chelans, who occupied the Chelan Falls area and Lower Lake Chelan. And north of that, the Metows, which is the way they used to say it. Now they call this river the Metow, but they used to call it Metow. And the Entiats, which are right over the mountain here in the Entiat Valley. And if you drove up from Wenatchee, you went through the town of Entiat and crossed the Entiat River at its mouth. That's where most of the Entiats lived, right in that area. And then the Wenatchees themselves, who occupied what they call Wenatchee Flats, which, if you come off of Highway 2 from the West Coast, is that area where Wenatchee is beginning to sprawl out around the bridge area there, and it goes all the way down to around the mouth of the Wenatchee River. That was always a great meeting place where the first trading post in this region was set up, and where the First Nations people used to meet for powwows and horse races and things like that. horse racing was, after they got horses, one of the things they did with them was horse race. And they used to bet on it, too. And one of the big gathering places was down at Wenatchee, where they would have their, I guess, their Sunday horse races or whatever. And so that was sort of the four divisions that we find here. They were all named after their river valleys that they lived in. They all could speak to each other. Their language was essentially identical up and down the river. They could also speak to the Columbias, although they said there were some differences. Very vague, but the only linguistic information we have is about Middle Columbia Salish, which is the Columbias. There is no differentiation of these groups over here, so they were obviously were able to talk to each other. The big chief over here, Moses, was a cousin to a couple of the chiefs on this side, and they obviously talked to each other. So, I mean, there was a lot of interrelationship. Now, a couple of the neighbors are worth mentioning. Down here around Yakima is the Yakima Reservation, the Yakima people, and for some reason, people have always thought this whole region was Yakima country, which is not true. It may have to do with the historical fact that the first big meeting between the government and the natives was down, well, it was actually at Walla Walla, but the Yakima chief was the big player. He was the one who was holding out with against the government negotiators, and so it was seen in the historical accounts that he was speaking for this whole region. And so even today people will say, well, isn't this Yakima country? Well, the Yakimas would like that, but for the purposes of land claims, things like that, but it's not the case. Then further over, there are the Spokanes and the Nez Perces over in Idaho, and further down, I think there's some Nez Perce country down in here in the corner of Washington. And they're significant because of Chief Joseph and the Nez Perce Wars. These people did not get involved directly in the Nez Perce Wars, but the fact that they were going on influenced a great deal what the government did locally, did and didn't do, because there are a lot of things the government just ignored because they were too busy with the Nez Perce. And the other thing was that Nez Perce country, just beyond the snake here, was considered by the local natives to be one of the worst spots in the world. One of the Chelan chiefs said, not even a grizzly bear could live up there. And so it meant something when the government said, well, either you do this or we'll banish you across the snake. They did not like to hear that. Banishment was one of the things that the government did. And really, this story is about the story of a disappearance of all these people, because there is very little trace of these people left. And dispossession, being dispossessed of their land. That's what the whole story is. And that we'll get into that in tomorrow's session, where we begin to talk about the treaties and the maneuvers that went on with the early territorial government. And of course, there's one other group I probably should mention, because they also play a role in all the negotiations and treaties, and that's the Walla Wallas, who come from down around Walla Walla. They're Sahaptin. Sahaptin is the group that the Nez Perce belonged to. The Walla Wallas, the Umatillas, they were all Sahaptin. And they were a different ethnic group, and as you may gather, I think the government had more trouble with them than they did the Salish people in this area. So that's kind of setting up the the sort of ethnic geography and what's happened there. Now, it's worthwhile thinking a little bit about the differences between the interior Salish people and the coast Salish people. The coast Salish people were what I would call beach people. They literally lived on 100 yards of beach. They were scared to death of the woods. They did not consider themselves hunters. They hunted, but it was not a main part of their diet to get deer and so forth. Deer was easy. They would walk out of the woods on the beach and they could get them. But as soon as you get into this country, you consider the ratio of population to salmon. The salmon is important, but it's not sufficient. And so they were hunters as well. In the fall and the winter, all of the people here went up into the mountains and hunted. Consequently, the Chelans and the Entiats probably came through this valley to hunt. It's known that they hunted up lake on Lake Chelan, but they lived down lake in the summer. But they had a hunting camp at Stehekin, and it was common for them to hunt in the Stehekin area, and no doubt they came up this valley as well. In fact, there is every year a hunt for deer up here. This is very populous with deer, and that was an important part of their diet. They also gathered roots. Most of the root gathering grounds were north and east of here. They gathered bitterroot and camas root, whereas the coastal people were not particularly root eaters. They had other vegetables. They ate seaweed, for one thing, which was another important reason why their diet was better. They both, of course, ate berries. Fall was a big berry gathering time. They would put up food like dried berries and so forth for the winter. But still, even given that sort of diet with roots and berries and salmon and venison and in a pinch goat, because they used to hunt goats. They hunted the goats for the hides and the horn and the bones more than they did for the meat, because they prefer venison if they could get it. But because of the winter here, as you may know, we get a lot of snow here. They often face shortages in the spring if it was not a good hunting season. Further to the east, you get more and more game eaters and less salmon as a proportion of the diet. And of course, as you go, if you get into Montana, you get into the buffalo hunting culture. As I said, they got into buffalo hunting in the 18th century when they got horses. And they would take long trips from here. It was started by an old chief of the Columbias called Skultoskosum, who decided this would be a good thing to go get buffaloes and hides and everything. It would take these big entourages, including many of the people from the West Bank, across the mountains into Montana. And this was very difficult work, because hunting buffalo was difficult, but there were also the Blackfoot people to deal with, who didn't particularly like people coming in and taking away their buffalo. So they had wars over this. The wars with Blackfoot over buffalo hunting went on in the 18th century. There aren't any documentary things about this, but these are stories that are told by the elders and have been recorded early on in this century. As I said, the history that this comes from is mostly clippings and manuscripts and things that were in shoeboxes that had to be sifted through to find all this. They lived along in their winter villages, and the north shore here between Manson and Chelan was the prime area where many of the Chelans lived. They lived in winter villages made up of these lodges. It would be about 15 feet wide and anywhere from 30 to 50 feet long, dug down in a pit. And they'd have timbers for roofs. They'd have these peaked roofs with an opening for smoke. And it would be covered with mats that they would weave from tule leaves. And that was their winter habitation. In the summer, they would they would have a different summer village, and that would be usually teepees. They were moving around, of course, to do different things, to go fishing and so forth. In fact, if you you consider the fishing that they did, they used traps and spearing to catch salmon. You can't just go down to the Columbia and stand there and throw spears. You have to have a place where you're going to see the fish. And so there were particular places where they would jump, and they would spear them from these platforms they would build out. And there were two places in this whole region which were used by all of the native people to catch salmon. And one of them is down here by the Dalles. Where it is, and here's the Dalles Dam is right here. Underneath what is now this lake that the Dalles Dam has formed is what used to be called Celilo Falls. And it was a very rocky falls where hundreds of fishermen could fish with spears at the same time. There were many, many fishing platforms built out over the falls. And so there would be 2,000 or 3,000 First Nations people camped around this in September and October.
Even the people from the Manson area,
yes,
would go that far?
Yeah. They would go that far. And it's interesting that they all saw this as a common resource. So everybody was welcome to come and fish. The other place was around Leavenworth on the Wenatchee River. There were, and there was a, also on the Chihuahua River, which is a little bit, I gather from the descriptions, it's all around in the plain region, that the there was another fishery that was very, they were described as very abundant. It's certainly not as abundant now as it was then, but it was one of the important gathering places, and whenever there were treaty discussions, they wanted to make sure that the white settlers are going to have hands off these fishing places. And one of the way things ended up, the Wenatchees got their noses really out of joint later on, because one of the last negotiations with Washington sort of ignored their fishery here and left it wide open. Didn't reserve it for the native people like they had always done. I guess from descriptions I've read about the Chelans, at one time there could have been as many as 1,000 people living in the Lake Chelan area. That includes down the falls to the Columbia and the Columbia below Chelan. That was sort of the traditional villages of the Chelans. There were villages up and down the lake as far up lake as 25 Mile Creek for permanent winter villages. There was one there. That was one of the bigger creeks. In fact, they called it Big Creek. And both of the state parks on Lake Chelan had permanent villages there before the state parks were there. It's hard to count because, of course, villages might have been abandoned and the same people moved somewhere else, so you can't really tell for sure, but it looks like as many as 1,000 people lived here at one time. And by the 1880s, there were only about 300. So that's the picture that we get. What I want to do is set up what we have to say tomorrow, which is about all of the white settlement. Before I do that, I want to go over some of the main characters from the First Nations side, the chiefs of the region. We don't know a lot about the genealogy of the Chelan chiefs because they don't have stories that give us that. There was, in the 19th century, the main player for the Chelans was a chief named Yenemasitsa. And that word means the rainbow robe, and he was quite a flamboyant character. One of the villages was named after him. That must be where his
chiefly clan always lived, because the chiefs were always named the same thing, kind of like pharaohs, which was very confusing because he had two sons, both named Yenemosetsa. So they always took English names. There was Yenemosetsa Bill and Yenemosetsa Jim. Jim later completely anglicized his name. He was called Long Jim. And anyway, Yenemosetsa was the chief of the Chelans through most of the white settlement period, and he directed what they did, and he was known as a great warrior. So he was involved in a lot of the carrying on that went on between the military and the settlers and the miners and the native people. We do know a lot more about the families of the Entiats. And the Entiats are important for Lake Chelan because they ended up living on Lake Chelan. By a quirk of the way land was allotted, they ended up owning Wapato Point. And Wapato John is an Entiat chief from up the river, or down the river further. The first Entiat chief that we know much about was a fellow who died in 1790 named Shilhuhask Saskat. The first one was before that, but he was the first Entiat chief that there's any story about. His son was the one who died in 1790, and they know that he died in a hunting accident in an avalanche above Stehekin. They were on a goat hunting trip in the winter, and an avalanche caught some of the hunting party, including the chief. There's quite a story with this, because then his wife became acting chief, his mother became acting chief, and she banished his wife because she decided she had too many children, and the reason he was out in the middle of the winter hunting was to feed all those mouths, and it was her fault. So, you know, even in their cultures, there are scapegoats. And
what did banishment mean?
The way they did it was they picked up their village and moved and left that person behind. And said, you may not live in the village anymore. The stories say that some of the people from the village, though, had some mercy on her and left her a cache of food, and she was able to survive the winter, because then her son, Shilhuhask-Saskat III, the third, was Wapato John's half-brother, and he was the actual chief of the Entiats who did most of the negotiating with Washington and so forth. And he lived in the Entiat Valley and was the reason that the Entiat Valley was not settled early on, because basically if settlers tried going up the Entiat Valley, they got a seat of the pants full of buckshot, because he just didn't want people around him. Although the old settlers that he knew, the guys who ran the trading posts and so forth, he invited into his house and told stories to and stuff like that. It was just new people he didn't want anything to do with. He finally died in the late 1880s or so. He was quite old. I think he was the one who lived to be 112. I think he died about 1890.
He didn't even know about cholesterol.
Yeah. And his grandson, Wapato Peter, no, it wouldn't have been his grandson, but his half-brother's son, Wapato Peter, was 100 years old. So they were a long-lived bunch. But the sort of big player for the Entiats was Nkwilakin, or Wapato John, who lived from 1825 to 1911. And he became the big merchant of this area, had a big ranch, had a trading post. And it's interesting that he was not one of the big political chiefs, but when it came time to go to Washington, they took him because he was highly regarded by all the white settlers. as they thought of him as a good businessman. He also lived on Ribbon Cliff. If you've driven up from Wenatchee, you know there's a place called Earthquake Point.
Mm-hmm.
That's Ribbon Cliff. And he was there in the great earthquake of 1872. His roof fell in. It was quite the story. His family had to then sleep outside in light snow. This was a really big earthquake because it actually dammed up the Columbia there for about 24 hours. All the stuff came off that cliff into the river. The Wenatchee sent scouts upstream to see what was going on with the river because it kept going down.
Mm.
Then the dam broke about a day later and started flowing again. But it flooded out some of Wapato John's stuff. Although he lived higher up, it didn't flood out his house. And then Wapato Peter, who was Wapato John's son, was born in 1849 and died in 1949. Had a lot to do with the shape of Chelan, and because he was the leader of that group that began to lease out their land around Manson, and they are still the owners of the land where many of the resorts and the casino and some of the condos and stuff are located. And Wapato Peter died a very wealthy man from his land income. And his grandson, Bill Evans, is still a Chelan resident and involved in...
he's a Manson resident. He lives three houses down from me,
yeah.
Manson.
Right, but he was the... Like, he's been the Grand Marshal of the rodeo and things like
mm-hmm,
that.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the Chelans, the Entiats. The Columbias have a couple of important characters. Sulk Toscosum, as I told you, in the 1700s, was the fellow who led all of the local peoples into the sort of plains culture, taught them how to go to buffalo hunting, ride and carry on war on horses and things like that. But one of his grandsons, Quetelitsin, who later became known as Chief Moses, was actually the big political leader of this region. And it was he who always was the one Washington talked to. And so he seemed to speak for the nations of this area. He was also the cousin of Chief Joseph, the chief of the Nez Perces, who gave Washington so much trouble. And he played this off like a seasoned diplomat. He'd always tell the general or whoever he was talking to, well, you know, I've got my cousin Joseph there. I really should be helping him. What can you do for me? He was a sly old character, but in the end, the people on the West Bank were not well served by some of the deals he made. And we'll get to that tomorrow. I'm going to finish up just taking a look at some of the first things that happened when the white... settlers came. Just briefly look at the first contact. The first contact that is recorded, what happened with the Meetow people, the people from the next valley up, who were cousins of all these other folks. They must have been gone down to fishing. It was in the fall of 1805. The Lewis and Clark expedition note in their journal that among the people they contacted one day was a group they called themselves the Meetows. So they were the first ones of this bunch to be recorded as having made contact. They were also apparently still there in the spring of 1806 when Lewis and Clark came back through the other direction. Not much else was said about them. They were just sort of, you know, in the enumeration of all the different native groups, they were listed there. But in 1811, David Thompson, who was a Canadian, well, of course he was British then, but based in Canada, a fellow who discovered the Thompson River, which is one of the main tributaries of the Fraser, decided to come down to Fort Vancouver, and he came down the Okanagan River
And he records all four of these groups as having actually stayed with them. They were very generous. They gave them salmon and everything. And they came on down here. And they came to Port Vancouver and discovered that the competition had arrived at Astoria. John Jacob heard the Astor family's Pacific Fur Company had set up a post. This was what was going on at that time in 1811. Britain and the U.S. were sort of competing for who could extract the most resources from this area, and fur, of course, was one of the things that they were after. So there was a great competition between the fur companies, the Hudson's Bay Company and the Pacific Fur Company, to sort of get into these markets, as it were. Consequently, in 1811, David Stewart, who was an employee of the fur company in Astoria, came up here traveling with Thompson for much of the way, and decided to put a fur trading post here in Okanagan. And so that was how Fort Okanagan was established in 1811. Forts in those days were not outposts to wage war against the First Nations people, but they were fur trading posts, basically. But they were forts because they held all the valuables. So that was the setup there. There was a fort here. Of course, there was the big establishment at Fort Vancouver. Where did Vancouver go? There we go. Right here, down at this end of the Columbia. And those were the first areas where you would find the Europeans arriving. And so they were the points of first contact. It wasn't until later in the 1870s that missionaries arrived. They were Catholic. The first mission was near Kashmir, over on Highway 2, St. Francis Xavier Mission. And there was a certain Father Grassi, he was an Italian missionary, who found it very rough going as far as trying to convert the local natives. There were a number of problems. If we look briefly at their religious and cultural beliefs, for one thing, they were polygamous. It was common for a man to marry two sisters. They liked sisters, presumably, because they already got along. But it would also simplify the negotiations because you always paid a bride price, so you could deal with one father-in-law, right? It's kind of two for the price of one. Well, of course, the Catholic missionaries arrived and began preaching against polygamy, and they did not like that much. In fact, they would go to the government representatives, whether it was Bureau of Indian Affairs or the Army, and argue that they ought to please send us some Protestant missionaries, because the word had gotten out that Protestant missionaries didn't preach against polygamy. As far as their religion goes, they were animists. That is, that they believed that God was in everything. And they had stories that more or less go from that premise. So that certain artifacts, religious artifacts, were important to them because they represented spiritual values or spiritual powers that were crucial to things like war or abundance of food or whatever. The local people had the practice from further east in the plains of counting coup, which means that you would take your spiritual powers, which would be what, an eagle feather or some symbol that you got on your spirit quest, and you put it in your pouch and you would ride through the enemy with no weapons. And you would essentially go up to some great warrior and just hit them with your hand. And this had to be witnessed. And then you would ride back. And of course, the idea was that all of this hail of arrows going on around you would leave you untouched. And you'd ride back to your people and you would scored, this showed what great magic you had in your pouch. Very treacherous deal. But the idea was that the more you counted coup, you know, the more notches you had in your holster, so to speak, you were the greater your magic was. And kids as young as 7 years old were sent on their spirit quest, which meant they were taken up in the mountains, usually by a grandparent, left there with no fire, no food, nothing. And you were left in the wilderness for several days at a time. And the whole idea of this was for you not to sleep, not to eat, but to wait for your magic to come to you. And usually it came in the form of a song. And some kids never, I mean, 1 out of 10 never really got this power. But the idea was that you would get a spirit song of some kind that would involve, let's say, an eagle, which then meant that you needed to get an eagle feather as a symbol of your magic. But every child did this. You think how terrifying this must be for a 7 or 8 year old left in the woods in the mountains for 3 nights, and probably cold and dark and everything else. And they would bring you back until the song came to you eventually. It took 2 or 3 times sometimes. So that's the kind of religion they had. They had medicine men who were dreamers, and things would come to them in visions. One of the famous ones in the middle of Colombia named Smohalla also was later revealed to have an almanac, so that's why he was so good at predicting the weather. But his reputation was made in the fact that he predicted the big earthquake of 1872. They all believed him after that. They would go into these trances and see these things. They were sort of like prophets, I guess. I just wanted to briefly read you a short coyote story that gives you an idea of how they explained things. Coyote is responsible, according to their belief, for all the salmon in the Columbia. They said that the river once didn't have any salmon because there was a large fish trap that was made by 4 wicked sisters way down at towards the mouth of the river. So Coyote came along and removed the fish trap so the fish could get further up. And then he made Celilo Falls, which was their big fishery place. Then he walked along the banks of the Columbia with hordes of salmon following him upriver. As he went, Coyote removed every obstruction and dam on the river all the way to Kettle Falls, which is way up north. It's up, of course this is all dammed up now, but it was up here. The salmon were so thick that Coyote made Beaver the salmon chief. Beaver had to promise to let all the Indians share in the bountiful harvest of salmon and make sure no one was greedy. And this was their ethic as far as sharing the fishery was. This is the way they operated. There weren't any wars over salmon. There's another story about how Coyote created the Chelan Gorge. And this is an idea, an example of how the land is interrelated with their mythology. They have particular stories that relate to landmarks and how they came to be. He got angry because there was a lovely girl who refused his marriage proposal. Coyote was always proposing to people and disguising himself as great warriors and coming to try to trick people or women in marrying him. He noticed the beautiful daughter of a Chelan chief fishing for salmon in Lake Chelan. Now, there aren't any salmon in Lake Chelan. I mean, there weren't any who ran up the Chelan River. So he decided to ask for her hand in marriage. When Coyote asked this girl's father if he could marry his daughter, the chief refused in no uncertain terms. This so enraged Coyote that he immediately threw huge boulders into the Chelan River. The boulders created rapids and falls that have ever since prevented the salmon from navigating upriver to the lake. So this is the explanation why the salmon couldn't get into Lake Chelan. If that had been true, it would have been a colossally good sockeye run, because sockeye run up a river into a lake. As it is, there are landlocked salmon in there from some former time, but there's no salmon run up the river. But they needed an explanation for that. So it was, again, as most things, coyote's fault. Well, as I said, into this situation, the missionaries eventually came. The Entiats, the Shilkohasket, decided he wasn't going to give up polygamy, but unfortunately for him, his wives did. They converted. And this made him eternally mad at the Father Grassy, because it broke up his household. One of them moved off and decided to live, stop living in sin, as it were. Yenemositsa did not like Father Grassy at first. For one thing, he didn't like that he didn't speak the Chelan dialect. So the next year, Father Grassy came back, was speaking the Chelan dialect. And no matter how much Yenemositsa insulted him, he wouldn't go away. So actually, he began to respect the father. And he finally allowed him to preach in his villages, and he began to get converts among the Chelans. But then, Father Grassy was transferred, and so he reverted completely. He didn't like the new father at all. And he also was very shrewd in noticing some of the hypocrisy that went on, and argued with the father about some of this stuff. He told the new missionary, "Go away from my land. You always come here to reprove us for our customs." And he was thinking of polygamy too, because he never did give up his several wives. "Your Americans spent New Year's Day worse than we did. I saw them drunk and still drinking, quarreling and fighting. You are worse than we are, and yet you come here and urge us to become Christians." And he went on to, but that didn't stop. The priest insisted he should be able to preach in the villages like Father Grassy did. He said, "I will not allow you to talk to them. Nobody asked you to come here. We do not want your religion. We follow that of our forefathers. You heard we learned from our fathers, who were noble and glorious people. If we follow their example, we shall be as they were. And you have come here to tell us that these customs are bad, that we should give them up? You're an imposter." And then he actually gave him a speech about polygamy. He said, "You come here to destroy us. Our polygamy is our inheritance, which we have received from our forefathers. They were glorious people and had large numbers of hunters and fishermen and never knew what starvation was. In war, they were strong and defeated their enemies because they were many soldiers. You come among us and persuaded some of my people. They keep only one wife and have few children." Of course, this was a notion of wealth, too, as having lots of children, particularly for a chief, because the chief's clan was supposed to be the core of the warriors, and Yenemositsa was quite the warrior. "Our hunters and fishermen are disappearing, and in case of war, we shall have no soldiers. This is the evil in your speech." So he was very, very clear about that. On the other hand, Shilkohasket's half-brother among the Entiats, Wapato John, became not only converted, got most of his family converted, and actually became very devout and assisted at Mass, and he integrated into the white culture very quickly, including the religion. And there is, I don't know if there's still, is there still a St. Francis Xavier Church in Chelan?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That was a branch of the mission.
Oh, was it?
From Kashmir, yeah.
Yeah. Now it has two priests, one who is white and speaks English, and one who is Hispanic.
mm-hmm. from Mexico.
Yeah.
They have two services.
Right.
Yeah. One in Spanish and one in English. Times do change.
Yeah. But in the early part of the century, it was the Entiats who were sort of the pillars of that church.
Uh-huh.
Because of Wapato John.
That's interesting.
And not so much the Chileans. Oops. The woodpeckers are... Anyway, that sort of sets the stage for the beginnings of white settlement, which really caused a lot of changes in this area. And we'll get into that tomorrow. But for now, that's the story. Continue tomorrow.
Thank you.